So picture this. You are sitting at this chaotic, loud, like incredibly funny dinner with your oldest friends. Someone knocks over a glass, someone else makes a brilliant joke, and it is just this perfect, beautiful moment.
Right, just a great night.
Yeah. But instead of, I don't know, just laughing and letting the wine spill, you notice this weird shift in your own brain.
Oh, where you realize you are already mentally drafting the post about the night.
Yes,
Right.
exactly. You are picking out the best adjectives to describe the spilled wine or, framing the joke for maximum impact. You are figuring out how to package this raw lived experience into a story to tell later.
Yeah, it is a profoundly modern condition. I mean, you are physically present at the table, but psychologically, you have levitated about 6 feet above the room. You are acting as your own biographer in real time.
That internal narrator just completely takes the wheel, turning your actual life into material. And today's deep dive is going to explore what happens when that specific instinct, that urge to narrate instead of experience, when that metastasizes and takes over a person's entire existence.
And we have the perfect lens for this. We are looking at a brilliant near-future novel by Howard Zimmern called Notes for a Future Reader.
Such a good
It
book.
really is. So it is set in 2034. Artificial intelligence has almost entirely automated coding, and human journalism is, well, it's teetering on the edge of being replaced by algorithmic text generation.
But Zimmering uses that sci-fi backdrop as this incredible psychological mirror. Our focus today is entirely on the protagonist, Nadia Shim.
Right. She is a top-tier journalist at the Washington Herald, and she is assigned to profile a man named Eli Sayer, who is effectively the last human coder left.
Which is fascinating on its own.
Totally.
Yeah.
But through Nadia, the novel builds this profound case study on emotional and professional detachment. I mean, for her, narrating life isn't just a quirky habit or a byproduct of her job. It is a highly evolved, impenetrable survival mechanism.
I want to start by looking at just how extreme this detachment actually is, because Zimmering doesn't just describe her internal state, right? He builds an entire physical architecture of isolation around her.
Oh, her apartment.
Yes. If you look at her apartment, it is completely sterile. It's hyper clean. There is absolutely zero personal clutter. It just described as if it is constantly waiting to be photographed.
Like a showroom.
Exactly. She doesn't even use her dining table. She eats all her meals standing up at this one very specific worn down crescent on her kitchen counter.
And she sleeps on her living room couch.
Right.
But she doesn't do it because she crashed after a long day of work. She does it purely out of this unexamined clinical habit. I mean, her actual bed is perfectly made in the other room, essentially functioning as a prop.
It's just furniture and a diorama of a life. But the detail that really locked this in for me is on her desk at the newsroom.
The photograph.
The photograph. She has a framed photograph of her father, but it sits face down on the wood. The text explicitly mentions she hasn't turned it over in 11 months.
And yet she checks its alignment against the edge of the desk every single morning.
It's compulsive.
It is. The author actually describes her checking it with the precision of someone confirming a lock.
Yeah.
Yeah, that word choice is very intentional. It is a lock. Internally, Nadia operates this massive mental machinery. It is this constant churning process that takes the messy, unpredictable data of human experience and instantly converts it into polished, safe prose.
She does it constantly.
Right. Even when she is completely alone, she catches herself crafting beautiful descriptions of the golden hour light hitting the quartz counter in her empty kitchen. I mean, she is constantly filtering the world into sentences so she doesn't have to touch it.
I kept thinking of it like a smartphone background app.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
You know those apps that constantly run in the background, pinging towers, tracking your location, pulling data, and just completely devastating your battery life?
Yep.
You don't even realize they are open, but they are dictating how the machine runs. But I am struggling with something here. I initially read her constant narration as just her being exceptionally good at her job. I
Sure.
mean, she is a writer. Writers observe. So is this actually a symptom of avoidance, or is it just the brain of a professional doing what it was trained to do?
It is definitely the latter masquerading as the former. Think about the mechanics of what her professional lens actually does to the world. It flattens it.
Okay, so.
Well, by turning everything she encounters into material or color for a story, she neuters the emotional threat of reality. She filters raw, unmediated human experience into usable quotes and narrative arcs.
Right.
If you are busy deciding whether a moment is the inciting incident or the climax of a story, you don't actually have to feel the moment. You maintain total control.
You stay safe.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the obvious question, right? What is she keeping safe from? What is behind the lock?
The father.
Yeah. We get her origin story halfway through the novel when she eventually reveals it to Eli. It entirely revolves around that face-down photograph of her father, Jinsu Shin.
Jinsu was a traditional letterpress printer in Annandale.
Mm-hmm.
He was an artisan in the truest sense, mm-hmm. you know, making tactile physical objects by hand.
And there is that beautiful sequence detailing how he used to check the quality of his work in the dark.
Yes. He would just run his thumb over the pressed letters on the thick cotton paper, just feeling the impression. His core philosophy was that the distance between the person who made a thing and the person who received it was sacred.
But his craft became obsolete. Digital printing wiped his shop out. And on the very last day the press ever ran, I think he was printing a batch of wedding invitations. Nadia was 14 years old.
Right.
She watched her father shut off the machine, and he just stood there silently with his hand flat on the bed of the press for an entire hour. He was mourning the end of his usefulness in the world.
And the defining element of that scene isn't just the father's grief. It is Nadia's physical position.
She didn't move.
No, she didn't cross the room to comfort him. She stayed frozen in the doorway. She makes this profound calculation in that moment. She realizes that if she crosses the room and stands beside him, the grief becomes real. It yeah. becomes hers.
So she stays back.
Yeah, she articulates it later in the book, watching with somewhere to stand.
Man, that line is devastating. Watching with somewhere to stand. She literally chose a profession based on that moment.
She did.
She became a journalist because she decided that if beautiful things were destined to disappear, someone should stand on the periphery and write them down.
Exactly.
But this feels like a chicken and egg scenario to me. Does a field like journalism naturally attract people who already need the safety of the doorway, or does the profession condition them to stay there?
I think it is a symbiotic relationship, but for Nadia, the instinct was definitely already there. Journalism just gave her a socially acceptable, even celebrated, framework to monetize her avoidance.
Monetize her avoidance. Wow.
Yeah. And understanding that origin is the only way to understand why Eli Sayer bypasses her defenses so completely.
Oh, because of his work.
Right. Look at Eli's life. He writes software code by hand for a local librarian, Mrs. Patterson. His overdue library notices are coded to say please.
That's so charming.
It is. He leaves hidden comments in his code, specifically designed to make a hypothetical future reader smile.
So he is treating code like cotton paper. He cares about the receiver of his work, just like her father did.
Exactly.
Eli is the obsolete artisan at the machine. He is vibrating at the exact frequency of her unmourned childhood trauma.
And because he is a perfect reflection of her father's lost world, Nadia's finely tuned machinery just starts to fail. The detachment app crashes.
The contrast between their physical spaces really highlights this too. Nadia goes to Eli's apartment for the profile, and it is the absolute antithesis of her sterile kitchen counter.
Oh, completely.
His place is warm, it's heavily cluttered, and it smells like old paperbacks and eucalyptus. He even has a gray tabby cat named Segfault, who sleeps directly on his keyboard while he works.
Which, if you understand programming terminology, is a deeply intentional naming choice by Zimmering.
Wait, really? What does it mean?
A segmentation fault? A segfault is a catastrophic system crash that happens when a program tries to access a restricted area of memory it isn't allowed to touch.
That is brilliant. Eli is quite literally accessing the restricted memory she has locked away, and it crashes her system.
Exactly. During one of these visits, she sits next to him while he writes code, and she experiences what the narration calls two unnarrated hours.
Unnarrated hours.
Yeah, her drafting machinery completely shuts off. She isn't framing the sunlight or mentally describing the smell of eucalyptus. She is just sitting in a room experiencing time.
Just being a person.
Right. And Eli is highly perceptive. He notices this tension in her. During a conversation, she deflects a moment of genuine intimacy by deploying this cynical, perfectly polished journalistic joke.
Typical Nadia.
Yeah, but instead of laughing, Eli just looks at her and delivers one of the most piercing lines of the novel. He says, "You write like someone who's hiding inside her own sentences."
Oof. When someone sees through your armor that clearly the script you've been relying on just combusts.
Completely.
But the absolute breaking point happens when Eli tells her the story of his mother, well, right?
Yes. So it turns out his mother has early onset dementia. She used to be a beloved middle school music teacher, and she was terrified of forgetting her students.
That is so sad.
It gets worse. So Eli secretly built a custom application that automatically sends birthday messages to her former students, just so his mother wouldn't realize the disease was taking her memories.
It is a raw, agonizing confession of a son's helplessness. And watch what Nadia's brain does in that exact moment. Her journalistic machinery immediately reboots.
Yes.
It coldly flags this tragic story as the emotional center of the piece. It literally starts formatting his pain into a narrative climax.
But this time, because her defenses have been compromised by his presence, she catches the machinery working.
Right.
For the first time in 12 years, the automation of her own detachment physically sickens her. She puts her pen down and takes zero notes.
She's staring down the barrel of genuine connection.
Exactly.
But I find her next move completely baffling. I mean, she is clearly falling for him. The walls are coming down. But she still has a deadline for the Herald.
She does.
When she goes back to her sterile apartment and faces the blank screen, the fear just overtakes her. Instead of protecting him, she weaponizes the intimacy she just gained.
She writes the profile.
She writes the profile, but she completely abandons her journalistic distance. She writes a devastatingly beautiful, intimate portrait of him, effectively a love letter, and publishes it to the world. Why would she feed him to the machine if she loves him?
Because that is the only way she knows how to process intense emotion.
Mm.
She took the terrifying, raw vulnerability she felt in his apartment and immediately shoved it into her machinery to make it manageable.
Ah.
She didn't do it maliciously. I mean, she did it to survive her own sudden exposure. But you have to look at the mechanics of what happens next. The article goes viral.
Of course it does.
And the public consumes Eliza's private grief with a voracious, terrifying appetite.
It explodes. A literal crowd forms outside his apartment building.
Yeah.
You have politicians and cable news talking heads using Eli's mother's dementia as a rhetorical prop to debate automation and human dignity.
Yeah.
They turn a real person's specific tragedy into a generic, flattened talking point.
And this actually mirrors a scene from earlier in the novel where Nadia visits a Smithsonian exhibit about the history of computing.
Oh, right.
They had a piece of human-written code displayed in a glass case, treating it like a dinosaur fossil. The museum had entirely museumified the human coder. Nadia realizes she has just done the exact same thing to Eli, using her prose instead of glass.
She put his soul in a display case for the internet to stare at. And when Eli confronts her, it is brutal. He cuts off all contact.
Yeah.
He tells her, "I need the room or I'm not a story, Nadia. And I don't think you can be in this room without making it one."
So powerful.
She didn't betray him by writing a hit piece or telling a lie. She betrayed him by telling the absolute truth.
It highlights the central paradox of her entire worldview. In journalism, exposure is theoretically supposed to grant light. I mean, it's supposed to honor the subject by making them seen.
Right.
But here, as the narrator states, the fidelity was the betrayal. Her precision, you know, the beautiful care she took in describing his pain is exactly what made the damage so surgical.
That makes total sense.
The news cycle ate the one thing she cared about specifically, because she prepared it so perfectly for consumption.
It is tragic, but losing Eli is the violent catalyst she actually needs. It forces her to dismantle the architecture she has spent a decade building. She has to finally step out of the doorway.
And we see this through a sequence of actions that require no dialogue. She returns to her desk at the newsroom. She reaches out and finally turns the photograph of her father face up.
Finally.
But she doesn't just see her father. She looks at the glass covering the photo and sees her own reflection layered over his face.
The AI connection. She realizes that she is now the obsolete artisan at the machine.
Exactly.
The Herald is testing AI generation software to replace reporters. And she realizes her ability to coldly process reality into text isn't special anymore. The algorithm can do it faster and with even less feeling.
Precisely. She sees that she has been operating like an AI long before the software threatened her job. So she quits.
She just walks away.
Yep. She walks away from the newsroom, abandoning the safety of her career.
And what she does next is so quietly powerful. She tracks down the memory care facility where Eli's mother lives, and she secretly, anonymously, takes over the monthly payments.
It's incredible.
She doesn't tell Eli. She doesn't write about it. It earns her zero credit and no narrative payoff. It is pure, unvarnished action without narration. It's like, it's the anti-content.
It proves she has learned to exist without the machinery. We also see her take out a beautiful Italian letter notebook and write a letter to her dead father.
Right, the messy one.
Yeah, she deliberately makes it messy. She leaves crossouts, fragmented thoughts, and raw, unpolished feelings on the page, knowing absolutely no one will ever read it.
And right before she walks out of the newsroom for the last time, she leaves that notebook open on her desk. She writes one final sentence for anyone to see. She writes, I have been narrating my life from a safe distance. I would like to stop.
It's beautiful.
It is like tearing down a theater set. You pulled down the beautiful painted backdrop of a Parisian street, and suddenly there is no audience, no script, just the actual exposed wood, the scaffolding, and the nails of reality.
Yeah.
It's terrifying because there is nowhere left to hide, but it is entirely liberating.
If we synthesize her arc, she transitions from someone who captures life in perfect dead sentences to a woman willing to stand in an empty room, completely empty-handed.
She lets go.
She learns to experience the world without immediately drafting a caption to shield herself from it. When she eventually reunites with Eli in the final pages, it happens largely in silence.
Wow.
They just exist in the quiet truth of his apartment. The narration stops, and the actual living begins.
If you look at how we live today, Nadia's journey is holding up a very uncomfortable mirror. I mean, we live in an era where everyone is a broadcaster.
Oh, without a doubt.
We are constantly turning our own lives into content packaging, an argument with a partner into a funny anecdote for a dinner party, or framing a beautiful sunset into a polished narrative for a feed.
We're all doing it.
We are all, in some small way, standing in the doorway watching our own lives happen. We use the narration to shield us from the sheer vulnerability of fully inhabiting the moment.
The machinery is running in the background for all of us, draining our capacity to just be present.
So here is a final thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day. Think about the most important relationships you have, the people you value the most. Oh. If you are entirely stripped of your ability to post about them, to describe their quirks to your friends, or even to internally narrate your experiences with them to yourself, what would be left in the silence?
That's a heavy question.
If the internal narrator stops drafting the story, are you brave enough to just be in the room?
That is a question that requires some real honesty to answer.
It really does. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. See you next time.